It's time for Eco Talk with host Betsy Rosenberg.
She'll be great. She's a very smart, capable person who knows exactly what took place and will lay out the facts. And that's what the American people want to see.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
Hello and welcome to Eco Talk, where we bring you the voices of visionaries at the very forefront of the next frontier. We hope that will be the sustainable frontier, and we hope it will not be our last on this beautiful planet of ours. Sometimes here at the program, we're ready to book Superman himself for advice on how we should make an eco U-turn and turn these things around that are really taking us off the cliff, if you believe some of the latest science, and why shouldn't we? Well, Superman wasn't available today, but a suspiciously Clark Kent-like journalist is with us. That would be Ross Gelbspan. He's a retired editor with the Boston Globe, the author of many books, including Boiling Point and The Heat Is On, that address climate change in particular. He specializes in brainstorming ecological solutions that are practical and workable, both for the economy and for our environment. Today, he'll be talking about recent action and inaction on climate change and the global solution strategy that he hatched with energy companies, policy wonks, and economists outlined in his book, Boiling Point. In our second half, we'll be speaking with Auden Schendler, director of environmental affairs for the Aspen Skiing Company. He'll tell us about the amicus brief that his ski resort filed with the Supreme Court and their green policies that he hopes will keep Aspen white in the winter. And yes, there is a global warming aspect to that. It's going to be a program mostly devoted to solutions about climate change, but I can't think of any more pressing and important topic to cover. EcoTalk is proud to be sponsored in part by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a science-based nonprofit combining independent research and citizen action to achieve innovative solutions for a healthy environment and a safer world. Find them on the web at ucsusa.org. Very pleased to welcome prominent journalist and author of many books and one of my super eco-heroes, Ross Gelbspan. He is a retired editor and reporter with the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe, but he's not out golfing. No, he's not taking retirement in any sense of the word, although he may be teed off. And given the way things are going or not going, let's say who can blame him. Ross Gelbspan, welcome back to EcoTalk.
Betsy, thank you so much for having me on the show again. I really appreciate it.
Well, we waited for you, but it was worth the wait. You've been on before. Your book, Boiling Point, in 2004, is one I quote regularly and tell people to read, and I think it's a good idea to get it for stocking stuffers with the holidays approaching. You outline macro-level policies that really just could work. And really, when I read about the problems and then the solutions in the same book, I said, this guy is the guy we should listen to. What has been the reception of the book in the 2 years since it came out?
It's gotten very good reception. The solutions ideas in particular have gotten very good receptions, in particular abroad. The book itself got a wonderful bump because Al Gore wrote a review that was the lead review in the Sunday New York Times Book Review right after it surfaced. And I was extremely grateful for that. And the solutions that we've been pushing have gotten very good responses. They were endorsed by Margot Wallström when she was the Environmental Commissioner of the European Union. We also got very strong endorsements from Sir Crispin Tickell, who was the British ambassador to the UN. So, and we've had a lot of correspondence with people around the world who've been interested in these types of solutions. So I could say that, except for in the United States, we've been very fortunate with the reception it's gotten.
Now, for those who have not read the book yet, the subtitle for Boiling Point is How Politicians, Big Oil and Coal, Journalists and, what is it, activists even, are fueling the climate crisis and what we can do to avert disaster. That's a long subtitle, but it's a very provocative one. Give us sort of a summary of how that is true.
How oil and coal are blocking us is fairly obvious,
yes.
And that's how I really got into this issue in the first place. Essentially, I found out that the coal industry was paying a few scientists under the table to say nothing's happening, and I said to myself, if there's this cover-up going on, what are they covering up? And there went the next 10 years of my life. So,
I hear you. A journalist who learned too much.
Exactly.
Can relate.
So it's very obvious what ExxonMobil's been doing, what Peabody Coal has been doing, and it's very understandable because the science is very clear. We need to cut emissions by 70%. And that threatens the survival of the coal and oil industries big time. So you can understand why they're fighting.
Journalists and activists.
Journalists, I think, have done a really, really dismal job in this area. They have, in the last year and a half, maybe since Katrina, they have been covering the issue of global warming more, but they very much are not indicating its urgency and magnitude. And for that reason, I think we've been very, very badly served by the journalistic community, at least in terms of the mainstream media outlets. They have not made the connection between all of these extreme weather events that are battering us all over the place. So essentially, I really feel, and having spent 30 years in the business myself, it bothers me very much to see what a terrible job the press has done on this issue.
I would completely agree with you. Up until maybe the last year, it seems like they are starting to connect the dots, beginning with Katrina.
They're starting to connect the dots, but you don't get a sense of the urgency and magnitude. And they are writing stories about very small emissions reductions and emissions reductions plans. They're not listening to what the science is saying, which is we have to do 70% reductions yesterday. And so for that reason, I think they're minimizing it, but you're right. It is much more on the radar screen than it has been certainly up until about the last year and a half.
And I hope it's, not too little too late.
Well, that's the real concern for sure.
Yeah, tipping point or breaking point. Well, let's talk about the tipping point. There's been just a series of really ominous developments from Jim Hansen, from James Lovelock, and others saying that we're quickly approaching the point of no return. I could cite examples. Tell us the ones that you often use to wake people up from their slumber.
Well, it's interesting. It's very interesting. You have three very, very prominent people saying we're either at the point of no return, that we passed the point of no return, or that we're very close to the point of no return. And what I find very interesting is that all three cite different phenomena to justify this conclusion. So, for example, Rajendra Pachauri, who was head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has come to this point because of the death of coral reefs and the very rapid and accelerating rate of ice melt up in the Arctic. Jim Hansen, NASA's Jim Hansen, is primarily concerned because of the rapid increase in sea level rise. And so he's very concerned about the fact that many of the world's coastal cities will be impacted and inundated and so forth. And then you have James Lovelock in Britain, and Lovelock is mostly worried about a big heating punch that's being held back from us by all the aerosols that are up in the air, all the low-level air pollution that actually exerts a temporary cooling effect. And Lovelock is concerned that when we really start to clean up our low-level air pollution, we'll see a very rapid spike in heating because that offset will be removed. So what I find very interesting is you have three experts here, all of whom are saying we're near the point of no return or at it, and they all have different pieces of evidence to cite for it.
Good point, and I'm pleased to say that Jim Hansen, James Lovelock have been on the program, as well as many others, including most recently, just last week, Julia Whitty, who did the cover article for Mother Jones on our dying oceans and how global warming is impacting the acidity and alkalinity levels of oceans.
Exactly.
All this news should make people stop in their tracks. Are you seeing that happening? And you recently gave a talk at MIT to engineers and economists. Were they alarmed?
They were alarmed for sure, and the talk really went through a number of points. It went through clearly a lot of the obstacles that we've seen from big coal and big oil. It also went through the set of solution strategies that I'd like to discuss here. But it also talked about dealing emotionally sort of with this point of no return, and I think that's very important. I think it's necessary for us to sort of look reality in the eye and stand up and begin to deal with what we're looking at. So, for example, one of the things that we hear very frequently is, gee whiz, you know, we could probably pacify the climate, but it's going to be too expensive. And I think what's really important to understand is the real economic issue in rewiring the globe with clean energy is not cost. The real economic issue is whether or not we have a large enough labor force to accomplish its task in time to meet nature's deadline. But we were also talking about the fact that I think we're already up against nature's deadline, and we don't have any precedents to guide us for this one. We're really crossing a threshold into uncharted territory.
We don't have any precedents or precedents.
That's right. So I think we have just our own hearts to consult and our intellectual integrity to look reality in the eye and whatever courage we can muster and a sort of dedication to a human future that reflects the combined aspirations of probably everyone who's listening to this program.
How about looking our children in the eye?
Talk
about motivation.
Very difficult also, for sure. I have two daughters who are in their oh, they're both around 30, and by the time they're my age, and I'm in my mid-60s, this is going to be a very, very chaotic world to navigate.
I remember when I last spoke to you, you said you're worried about your daughter's futures, and your daughters are quite a bit older than my daughter, so that was really alarming. We're going to continue our conversation with Ross Gelbspan. It may be alarming to hear what he has to say, but it is about the most important thing you can possibly take in. He also has the solution, so stay with us. Ross Gelbspan, author, journalist, activist. I think we can call him an activist. Environmentalist, maybe, maybe not. We'll find out right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Eco Talk. We are in conversation with one of my heroes. I'm not ashamed to say that because he is the guy. He's the guy with a real sense of what the problem is, the urgency, and also the solutions. And they are realistic. They're not pie in the sky. His website is theheatisonline.com. His name is Ross Gelbspan. He's written books and he's been a newspaper editor who basically stumbled upon this story of global warming and has not slept well since then. And I can relate to that. Mm-hmm. Welcome back, Ross. There was just this conference in Nairobi, Kenya, on climate change and Kyoto, and of course we're not a part of it, and of course the U.S. is very proud to continue to keep its head in the sand, sending their representatives to say nothing will change under this president. How come they don't just, you know, like tackle him and beat some sense into him?
You know what I've heard, which is something I've been expecting.
Arrest him or something.
Well, in the face of the U.S. reluctance, I've heard countries talk about taking economic reprisals against the United States. And in particular, I heard, and this was, some years ago, I spoke to representatives of the French, Swiss, and Canadian governments, and they were talking, this was just before Kyoto took effect, and they were talking about bringing the U.S. to court under the World Trade Organization. And their argument was, if all these countries are drawing down emissions according to the Kyoto schedule and the U.S. is not, and the WTO prohibits governments from subsidizing their products, and they were going to charge the U.S. with carbon subsidizing their products and move to put very stiff taxes on U.S. exports. Unfortunately, the terrorist attacks intervened. The coalition of the willing sort of put this stuff on the back burner. But I've seen that same line of thinking surface again just a few weeks ago. I think it was the president of France who mentioned something like this. And I think that's the kind of pressure that we need before this government is going to begin to really respond.
Sanctions against the U.S. I think it's a great idea, actually.
Yeah.
So you say on your website that what came out of that was delegates promising to get serious about combating, you know, CO2 emissions in 2008. And you say, I'm sure, why not now? And how dare we even wait 2 years when there's so little time to waste?
It's insane. But again, it's because of U.S. opposition. It's because the U.S. has persuaded China and Australia and India to some extent that, you know, we can't really act yet.
If we did act, Ross, would they come along? Because I've heard that China and India were sort of waiting in the wings back at the G8.
And their whole point has been, why should we begin to suffer any kind of deprivation if the U.S. isn't? And so that's essentially what they've been saying. Where the U.S. is so short-sighted here is that were we to extend clean energy to those countries, it would create so many jobs, it would really turn poor countries into trading partners, and it would expand the overall wealth of the global economy. But we're not looking at it this way, and I think the reason we're not is that essentially big coal and big oil are writing the energy and climate policies for the Bush administration. So I think what you're seeing here is really climate change having become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political system by money. That's what I think really accounts for this.
Not to mention what planetary deprivation would look like if we really continue to mess with Mother Nature and throw everything out of whack.
Absolutely.
So if they're not going to get serious, let's us get serious. In the last chapter of your book, Boiling Point, you outline a global solution strategy. What should we do at this relatively late stage in the game, knowing what we know, even since you wrote your book?
I still think we have no choice but to move in that direction, Betsy. And the reason I like these strategies is they are global in scale. Every country can participate in them, and they involve three elements, and I'll go through them very briefly. In the industrial countries, take away the subsidies for coal and oil and put them behind renewables. They involve creating a large fund to transfer clean energy to poor countries. And they involve a regulatory mechanism that would have every country increase its fossil fuel efficiency by about 5% a year. And let me just speak for a minute about each of these. On the subsidy front, the U.S. spends about $25 billion a year subsidizing coal and oil. In the industrial countries overall, that's $200 billion a year. We're saying take that money away from coal and oil, put it behind renewables. The oil companies will follow the subsidies, and they'll become aggressive developers of solar panels and windmills and fuel cells. And it would, that subsidy shift would also bring out of the woodwork an army of energy engineers and entrepreneurs in an explosion of creativity that I think would rival the dot-com revolution of the 90s. We also need to create a large fund to transfer clean energy to poor countries, and there is no resistance on that front. It's just a question of cost. The most air-polluted cities in the world are in China and Bangkok, Thailand, and Santiago, Chile, and Mexico City. They'd love to go clean energy. So we're proposing a tax on international currency transactions, which total about $1.5 trillion a day, and if we taxed them at the rate of a quarter of a penny on a dollar, that would net out to about $300 billion a year for a decade to jumpstart renewable energy infrastructures in poor countries. And the mechanism that would make this all work is a progressively more stringent fossil fuel efficiency standard that goes up by 5% a year. That means every country would start at their own baseline right now. They would increase their fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year. That means they produce the same amount next year with 5% less carbon fuel, or they would produce 5% more with the same amount of carbon fuel. And since no economy grows at 5% for very long, emissions reductions would outpace economic growth. And actually, if I can just say one more thing, it would happen much more quickly than that, because for the first few years, countries would meet this 5% just through efficiency, just by getting the waste out of their current energy systems. But after those cheap efficiencies ran out, they would meet the 5% by using more and more renewable technologies, and that would create the mass markets and economies of scale that would bring down their prices and make them economically competitive with coal and oil.
Great. We're going to continue speaking with Ross Gelbstein right after the news break. Stay with us, and you'll hear more about what needs to be done now to turn climate change around. Ross Gelbstein for president, speaking with the author and journalist and a creator of a wonderful website, great resource for climate change, theheatisonline.org, not .com. And thank you for correcting me, Ross, on that. When we went to break, you were talking about what you call the Tobin tax, and you say that would not be an income tax. It would be a commerce tax.
That's right. This tax on currency transactions, the Tobin tax, is essentially a tax on the conversion of currencies, or when people buy imports and the currency gets changed and so forth. And as I said before, the commerce in these taxes today is about $1.5 trillion every day. And if they were to be taxed at the rate of a quarter of a penny on a dollar, that would net out to enough money to help outfit the developing world with clean energy. There should not be a lot of opposition to it, because this does not come out of taxpayer pocket. Think of it as a small tax on global commerce to essentially preserve the global environment.
Well, it makes so much sense that I'm wondering, you've probably shared this with Al Gore and other political leaders, and what has been their response?
Off the record, Al Gore likes the idea. On the record, I don't think he thinks it's going to help him get elected if he wants to run for office. So for that reason, I think he's giving it a bit of a leaving alone, and I can understand that.
Okay, so you're going to run, right?
Not at all, but
But Betsy,
don't get hung up on the Tobin tax. You can also get this money from carbon taxes. You can get it from a tax on international airline travel. The real important point here is that you have a plan to rewire the whole world with clean energy. And the real economic upside of that is how many jobs that would create in developing countries.
Let's talk about that, because what we heard about the argument against CAFE standards a few years ago, which would have been the right thing to do, you know, strengthen the fuel efficiency of American cars, is it's going to cost jobs. Have we pretty much proven that that's not the case, or what's the argument you're making now to anyone who still brings that up?
The argument in this case is very clear, and this comes from discussions I had with a man named Morris Miller. He was a former executive director of the World Bank back in the 80s, and almost everything he was writing was devoted to the fact that every dollar you invest in energy in poor countries creates way more jobs and far more wealth than the same dollar invested in any other sector of the economy.
Go to our website for more information at ecotalk.net.